Shaza was angry and humiliated. He had never offered to divorce Tara for any other woman. Had never even contemplated it. And Kitty had laughed at him. There were well-explored avenues down which he knew he could cure his anger. One was the hunt. For Shaza, nothing else existed in the world when the hunter's passion thrilled in his blood. When a bull buffalo, big as a mountain and black as hell, came thundering down upon him, bloody saliva drooling from its raised muzzle, the polished points of its curved horns glinting, and murder in its small pig-like eyes. However, this was the rainy season, and the hunting grounds in the north would be muggy, wet, and malarial, and the grass high above a man's head. He could not hunt, so he turned to his other sure panacea, the pursuit of wealth. Money held endless fascination for Shaza. Without that obsessive attraction, he could not have accumulated such a vast store of it, for that required a devotion and dedication that few men are capable of. Those that lack it console themselves with old platitudes about it not buying happiness and being the root of all evil. As an adept, Shaza knew that money was neither good nor evil, but simply amoral. He knew that money had no conscience, but that it contained the most powerful potential for both good and evil. It was the man who possessed it who made the ultimate choice between them, and that choice was called power. Even when he had believed himself to be totally absorbed with Kitty Godolphin, his instinct had been in play. Almost subconsciously, he had noticed those tiny white specks way out on the green Benguela current of the Atlantic. Kitty Godolphin had not been gone from his life more than an hour before he stormed into the offices of Courtney Mining and Finance in Vinthook's main street and started demanding figures and documents, making telephone calls, summoning lawyers and accountants, calling in favours from men in high places in government, dispatching his minions to search the archives of the registrar and the local newspapers, assembling the tools of his trade, facts, figures, and influence, and then losing himself happily in them, like an opium eater with his pipe. It was another 5 days before he was ready to bring it all together and make the final weighing up. He had kept David Abrams with him, for David was an excellent sounding board in a situation like this one, and Shaza liked to bounce ideas off him and catch the returns. "So this is what it looks like," Shaza began the summing up. There were five of them in the boardroom, sitting under the magnificent Pierre-Nief murals that Santon had commissioned when the artist was in his prime. Shaza and David, the local manager and secretary of Courtney Mining, and the German lawyer based in Windhoek, whom Shaza kept on permanent retainer. "It looks like we've been asleep on our feet. In the last 3 years, an industry has sprung up under our noses, an industry that last year alone netted £20 million, 4 times the profits of the Honey Mine, and we have let it happen." He glowered, cyclops-eyed, at his local manager for an explanation. "We were aware of the recommencement of the fishing industry at Walvis Bay," that unfortunate gentleman sought to explain. "The application for pilchard trawling licenses was gazetted, but I didn't think that fishing would match up with our other activities. With due respect, Frank, that's the kind of decision I like to make myself. It's your job to pass on all the information, of whatever nature, to me." It was said quietly, but the three local men had no illusions as to the severity of the reprimand, and they bowed their heads over their notepads. There was silence for 10 seconds while Shaza let them suffer. "Right, Frank," Shaza ordered him. "Tell us now what you should have told us 4 or 5 years ago." "Well, Mr. Courtney, the pilchard fishing industry was started in the early 1930s at Walvis Bay, and although initially successful, it was overtaken by the Depression, and with the primitive trawling methods of those days, was unable to survive. The factories closed down and became derelict." As Frank spoke, Shaza's mind went back to his childhood. He remembered his first visit to Walvis Bay and blinked with the realization that it had been 20 years ago. He and Santon had driven down in her daffodil-coloured Daimler to call in the loan she had made to Delarey's Canning and Fishing Company and to close down the factory. Those were the desperate years of the Depression, when the Courtney companies had survived only through his mother's pluck and determination and ruthlessness. He remembered how Lothar Delarey, Manfred's father, had pleaded with his mother for an extension of the loan. when his trawlers lay against the wharf, loaded to the gunwales, with their catch of silver pilchards, and the sheriff of the court, on Santine's orders, had put his seals on the factory doors. That was the day he had first met Manfred de la Rey. Manfred had been a barefooted, crop-head hulk of a lad, bigger and stronger than Shaza, burned dark by the sun, dressed in a navy blue fisherman's jersey and khaki shorts that was smeared with dried fish slime, while Shaza had worn immaculate grey slacks, white open neck shirt, and a college sweater with polished black shoes on his feet. Two boys from different worlds, they had come face to face on the main fish wharf, and their hostility had been instantaneous, their hackles rising like dogs, and within minutes, jibes and insults had turned to blows, and they had flown at each other furiously, punching and wrestling down the wharf, while the coloured trawlerman had egged them on delightedly. He remembered clearly, even after all this time, Manfred de la Rey's pale, ferocious eyes glaring into his as they fell from the wharf onto the slippery, stinking cargo of dead pilchards. And he felt again the dreadful humiliation, as Manfred had forced his head deeply into the quagmire of cold, dead fish, and he had begun to drown in their slime. He jerked his mind back to the present, to hear his manager saying, "So the position is now that the government has issued 4 factory licenses to catch and process pilchards at Walvis Bay. The Department of Fisheries allocates an annual quota to each of the licensees, which is presently 200,000 tons. Shaza contemplated the enormous profit potential of those quantities of fish. According to their published accounts, each of those 4 factories had averaged £2 million profit in the last fiscal year. He knew he could improve on that, probably double it, but it didn't look as though he was going to get the chance. Approaches to both the Fisheries Department and to higher authority, Shaza had taken the administrator of the territory himself to dinner, have elicited the firm fact that no further licences will be issued. The only way to enter the industry would be to buy out one of the licensees." Shaza smiled sardonically, for he had already sounded out 2 of the companies. The owner of the first one had told Shaza in movingly eloquent terms to commit an unnatural sexual act on himself, and the other had quoted a figure at which he might be prepared to negotiate, which ended with a string of zeros that reached to the horizon. Despite his gloomy expression, it was the kind of situation in which Shaza revelled, seemingly hopeless, and yet with the promise of enormous rewards if he could find his way around the obstacles. "I want a detailed breakdown of balance sheets on all 4 companies," he ordered. "Does anybody know the Director of Fisheries?" "Yes, but he's straight, up and down," Frank warned him, knowing how Shaza's mind worked. "His fists are tight closed, and if we try to slip him, a little gifty, he'll raise a stink they'll smell in the High Court in Bloemfontein. Besides which, the issue of licenses is outside his jurisdiction," the company secretary agreed with him. "They are granted exclusively by the Ministry in Pretoria, and they won't be any more. 4 is the limit. That is the decision of the minister himself." 5 more days Shaza remained in Windhoek, covering every possible lead or chance with a total dedication to detail that was one of his strengths. But at the end of that time, he was no closer to owning a factory license at Walvis Bay than he had been when he had first spotted the little white trawlers out on the green ocean. The only thing he had achieved was to forget that malignant little sprite, Kitty Godolphin, for 10 whole days. However, when at last he admitted to himself that there was nothing more to be gained by staying on in Windhoek, and he climbed into the pilot's seat of the Mosquito, Kitty Godolphin's memory mocked him from the empty seat beside him. On impulse, instead of laying a course direct to Cape Town, he detoured westwards, heading for the coast and Walvis Bay, determined to have one long look at the site before finally abandoning the idea. There was something else besides Kitty's memory that plagued him as the Mosquito dropped down the escarpment towards the sea. It was a burr of doubt, a prickle of discomfort, that he had overlooked something important in his investigations. He saw the ocean ahead, wreathed in tendrils of fog, where the cold current brushed the land. The high dunes wreathed together like a nest of razor-backed vipers, the colour of ripe wheat and copper. and he banked the Mosquito and followed the endless beaches upon which the surf broke in regular snowy lines until he saw the Horn of the Bay spike into the restless ocean and the lighthouse on Pelican Point winked at him through the fog banks. He throttled back the Rolls-Royce Merlins and went down, brushing the tops of the scattered fog banks, and in the gaps he saw the trawler fleet at work. They were close into the land, on the edge of the current line. Some of the boats had their nets full, and he saw the silver treasure glittering through the water as the trawlerman raised it slowly to the surface, while over them hung a shimmering white panoply of seabirds, greedy for the feast. Then a mile away he picked out another boat hunting, cutting a foaming arabesque with its wake as it stalked yet another pilchard shoal. Shaza pulled on flap and banked the Mosquito steeply, turning above the trawler to watch the hunt develop. He saw the shoal, a dark shadow, as though 1,000 gallons of ink had been spilled into the green waters, and he was amazed by its size. 100 acres of solid fish, each individual no longer than his hand, but in their multitudes dwarfing Leviathan. Millions of tons in one shoal, he whispered. As he translated it into terms of wealth, the acquisitive passion flared up in him again. He watched the trawler beneath him throw its net around a tiny part of the gigantic shoal, and then he levelled out and flew at 100 feet, skimming the fog banks towards the maw of the bay. There were the 4 factory buildings standing on the edge of the water, each with its own jetty, thrusting out into the shallow waters, and black smoke billowing from the chimney stacks of the furnaces. Which one belonged to old Delarey, he wondered. On which of those flimsy structures had he fought with Manfred, and ended with his ears and nose and mouth filled with fish slime? He grinned ruefully at the memory. But surely it was further north, he puzzled, trying to cast his mind back 20 years. It wasn't down here, so close to the hook of the bay. He banked the Mosquito and flew back parallel to the beach, and then a mile ahead he saw the line of palings, rotted and black, running in an irregular line out into the waters of the bay, and on the beach the roofless old ruins of the factory. It's still there, he realized. And instantly his skin prickled with excitement. It's still there, deserted and forgotten all these years. He knew then what he had overlooked. He made 2 more passes, so low that the blast of his propellers raised a miniature sandstorm from the tops of the dunes. On the seaward wall of the derelict factory, whose corrugated iron covering was gnawed and streaked with red rust, he could still make out the faded lettering. Southwest African Canning and Fishing Company Limited. He pushed on throttle and lifted the Mosquito's nose into a gentle climbing turn, bringing her out of the turn on course for Windhoek. Cape Town and his promise to his sons and Isabella to be home before the weekend were forgotten. David Abrahams had flown the Dove back to Johannesburg, leaving a few minutes before Shaza that morning, so there was nobody in Windhoek whom Shaza would trust to conduct the search. He went down to the Registrar of Deeds himself, and an hour before the deed office closed for the weekend, he found what he was looking for. The license to capture and process pilchards and all other pelagic fish was dated the 20th of September 1929 and signed by the Administrator of the Territory. It was made out in favour of one Lothar Delarey of Windhoek. And there was no term of expiry. It was good now and for all time. Shaza stroked the crackling, yellowing document, smoothing out the crumples in it lovingly, admiring the crimson revenue stamps and the administrator's fading signature. Here in these musty drawers it had lain for over 20 years, and he tried to put a value on the scrap of paper. £1,000,000, certainly. £5,000,000, perhaps? He chuckled triumphantly and took it to the deeds clerk to have a notarized copy made. It will cost you a pretty penny, sir, the clerk sniffed. 10 and 6 for the copy and £2 for the attestation. It's a high price, Shaza agreed, but I can just afford it.